You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we are at the high point of Lent. Today is the 5th of April, 2023, and we're in the week of St. Mary of Egypt. I'm going to talk about something today that's relevant to all that's going on, whether it be political or otherwise. As I worked on my papers, a very long one, on Soviet psychiatry, not just the ideological foundation of it, but actually how it worked itself out in law, there really is no functional distinction, or no theoretical distinction, between the old Soviet approach to psychology and the modern American. I've been through 100 times the lengthy list of foundational similarities between Soviet Marxism, communism in general, and the Western advanced capitalist world. When I say advanced, I mean the postmodern, post-industrial world. And the way I'm going to do that is through someone who I've not dealt with before. And it's the great bishop, but less of a bishop than he was in Archimandrite, and that's Saint Ignatius Brantaninov, who lived he died at age 60, 1867, so through a very tumultuous time in Russian history, a pretty radical time. He died really before the left got going. He knew what they were. He knew what nihilism was. The scientific revolution, of course, is old by that point. But he was canonized a saint in 1988 as the Soviet Union fell to pieces. And most will say that he is one of the great, what we call neo-patristic writers of the 19th century. Very a high point of Russian theology. Well, he comes from a very wealthy family, or at least he comes from a large landowning family in Vologda, in the almost not quite in the far north, but close to it. When he wanted to become a monk, this wasn't, especially at the time, this wasn't a prestigious occupation. In fact, usually the families don't want this to happen. Monastic life was something to be avoided. There was no worldly glory there, and he began to realize that it's supposed to be a Russian Orthodox monarchy, and yet I'm struggling to even be able to go to a monastery. He was already the superior of Monastery of St. Sergius in Petersburg at 26. And it wasn't that long after that he became a bishop on the Black Sea, Caucasus, but he retired in only 4 years, and he remained on the Volga really to be a teacher. He withdrew from any kind of public life at all. And I want to do a few things here with him. He's extremely important. I don't even know if I've mentioned him before. He's best known for the book The Arena. The arena, he's referring to place of combat. He did have a military education, or at least in the sense he went to the military engineering school in Petrograd. This doesn't make him a military man, but it's he knew what was happening around him. And and he sees the Christian life as one of combat. He makes that very explicit because he was, to some extent, a spiritual advisor to Tsar Nicholas I as the Crimean War began. There's two parts of the area. That is by far his best-known work. It's been in English for a very long time. But I'm going to address a few other letters and short essays of his. As far as I know, have not been translated. The two parts of the arena I want to talk about is first, chapter 31. Now, he's addressing monastics, but no one just addresses monastics. That distinction exists, but isn't really, it's a formal distinction, it's not a substantial distinction. And chapter 31 is the struggles of monks at the last times, at the end times, and chapter 41, the meaning of the term world. Now, I want to get that out of the way first and then move on to other things. He was not a political writer, but much of what, I mean, he does comment on them. This wasn't atypical at the time. It's like Theophon the Recluse. He had very strong royalist political opinions. He was concerned about the influence of the West. It's always a negative thing at the time, then and now, in Russia. So he's not atypical in that regard. But he does talk about the end times. I mean, he's living in a time and a place that many of us would consider almost utopian compared to now, compared to the dystopia we live in now. And yet he is, well, he's aware what's going to happen in the future. He doesn't really have the vocabulary to talk about it. People talking about the end times centuries ago couldn't even conceive of what we suffer. And sometimes because we're so saturated with it, we don't realize that we're suffering. But he's criticizing his own time, which for us is just, you know, the high point of virtue, and it certainly is, by comparison. Needless to say, he is a firm believer, as far as church history goes, in devolution. He even starts off by saying that the ancient fathers and the early monastics were, by comparison to us, perfect beacons of virtue. When you read about them, it seems to be the case. He sees sin everywhere he goes, just as a, and we'll talk about this in a minute, as almost a integral aspect of the soul. But he talks about the ancient church. The church, you know, say roughly into the time of, prior to the turn of the millennium. He mentions that all of the revelations about what life is going to be like, monastic and otherwise, at the end time, the last times, the times that we have to be living in, that he says are going to have a very and extremely feeble life. It will not be given that abundance of spiritual gifts which the first monks enjoyed, and that the monks of the last days will even find salvation itself only with great difficulty. And he cites some of the ancient Egyptian monastics who talk about this at some length. They see things, but they can barely comprehend what they're seeing because really they're seeing what us today. The very fact that we understand orthodoxy at all is a victory that the ancient fathers would have absolutely marveled, especially, you know, not being in an Orthodox country, being in a country that not only is hostile to orthodoxy, that bombs it and wants it destroyed. And he quotes an Egyptian abbot, Iskirian, and he quotes him directly. He said, one of his students comes to him and says, "We've carried out the commandments of God, and what will those who come after us do?" And he said, "Well, they'll do half as much as we have done." They ask him again, "Well, what will those who come after them do?" And this Iskirian replies, "They won't have any monastic activity at it whatsoever. They will be permitted to have troubles and afflictions, and those of them who persevere will be superior to us and even our fathers." It's a common quotation, but only in context does it make any sense. It's almost impossible for them to consider what society has turned into. regardless of where you go. Obviously, some countries are better off than others. But for him, and for those who came before him, it would be an absolute disaster. So what it comes down to, that despite the fact that Christianity devolves into just, is reduced to next to nothing, he does say that those of us, the tiny handful of us that might survive, that might live a life of some sort of virtue within the church, we are going to be the ultimate martyrs, because we have to live their worst nightmare every single day. And that the only thing, and this is said over and over again, the only thing that saves the monastics of the last days, or the Christians of the last days, Orthodox people, is their own pain and their own suffering. Because without it, we have absolutely nothing, spiritually speaking. But he also says something else, and this is really almost a programmatic statement of his. And I'm quoting him directly here. Now, this is from the English. He says, "The fallen spirits saw that cruel, coarse, obvious temptations provoke in people a flaming zeal, courage to bear them. The demon saw this, and then he changed their tactics. He changed his coarse temptations to weak but subtle ones, which act very powerfully." And of course, they act this way because they don't evoke zeal. They're either of a intensely psychological nature that we may miss, that we or a very minor matter that we may dismiss, and then it festers and germinates over time. It doesn't strike us. I said this about the Antichrist too. This huge reveal of this Superman at the end times would do just this. It would inspire zeal and resistance and martyrdom. It's not going to come that way. It's going to be far more subtle. And as I've argued, that Adam Kadmon, the ultimate new man of the Kabbalah, is in fact Antichrist. That, of course, is far more arcane than having this, Superman at the head of everything. But he also says that these struggles, in his own day or now, and how much has changed since the 1840s, God sees everything. That the outwardly slight troubles, he says, the trials of his own day, are directed to draw men away from Christ and to destroy true Christianity on earth, leaving only a shell to deceive people more easily. He talks about a church history that saw almost an intensive perfection. And by perfection, I mean in need of nothing external. Doesn't mean they're perfect in the sense that they can do no wrong. That's improper. The definition is perfect, meaning it's whole in and of itself. It doesn't need anything outside of it. But he says, too, that the temptations that are slight, but he says slight but planned out, carried out with hellish wickedness, are more successful in the eyes of the demons than the grave but obvious attacks. Now, one of the things that he wasn't able to see is, while that's true, once the shell is left, and sometimes even the shell isn't left, people not only don't have the understanding of say, the Orthodox liturgy, but they don't have the capacity to understand the Orthodox liturgy. They've been dumbed down and reduced to ADD patients to the point where there's not much of a chance. I talked about stupidity last week, and it's an important idea. Stupidity has a lot to do with the foundations of knowledge, not knowledge itself. We're all ignorant on a bunch of things. Stupidity means that there's really no chance of changing. Now, Brezhnev is extremely prescient as far as his own day. He does say that while we are extremely weak and the temptations have increased. Now, temptations can remain weak, but because we're weak, it seems that it's extraordinary. And it has a, what he says, a seductive variety and attraction. That once we reach a level of sickness, this demonic image seems extraordinary to us. And how easy it is to draw us all away from God. But temptations, regardless of the time period, are permitted by God, and the moral misery, as he says, caused by temptations is also permitted. God is not, love doesn't mean you give in to every whim of humanity. It doesn't mean you create the utopia that people who, you know, blame God for terrible things happening to them. Utopia would mean no growth, no will, no intellect. In fact, it would be incredibly boring if God was to arrange the world in such a minute way that there's no suffering. No, suffering is a good thing. Suffering is what brings us out of our torpor at the moment. However, to insinuate itself psychologically into our mind without being blatant, this is how demons and the regime who serves demons function today. But life, he says, now this is in you know the 1840s. Life according to the laws of God is becoming very difficult on account of widespread general apostasy. The increasing apostates, by calling themselves and appearing outwardly to be Christians, will be all the more easily able to persecute the true followers of Christ. Now, there's one thing that I have to, you know, I disagree with the great saint about, and that's the old believers. He was a polemicist against them, and I'm not sure if that's what he's talking about here. Now, in America and Britain, you don't even have the outer shell. But, of course, the outer shell is exactly what the old believers said that the state-supported church has. I think that's often an extreme reaction, especially from here in 2023. It's the same, you know, it seems to be this relative deprivation where they live such a high level of Christian life and ritualistic tradition that even a small deviation seems like the end of the world, quite literally, in some of their minds. Could you imagine if they were able to see us? And Ignatius is saying this: we could barely, even in a monastic background, we can't do this. But he says ultimately, he says, stay where you are. And this is a common patristic idea. Doesn't get talked about very much. Don't go anywhere. Don't, because you should go to place. You're going to go to place, thing to thing, occupation to occupation, and you're not really going to find any satisfaction. The troubles and sins and problems are mostly internal, and you're going to bring those everywhere. Just stay where you are. To be uncomplaining and patient, bearing all troubles and sufferings permitted by the providence of God. And we know exactly what he's talking about there. There isn't much we can do at the moment. The commandments of the gospel teach us humility, while our crosses perfect that humility. The pride that we all have is slowly but surely crushed by the suffering and oppression that we have to deal with. Humility eradicates from our being all the sinful passion and draws it to the grace of God. And in that, he says, consists salvation. Chapter 41, and these are both the fundamental background writings of really his whole career. And I tend to gravitate towards those, trying to see really a system of thought in many of these writers. The meaning of the term world, we have to be careful to avoid equivocation. We can talk about the world in a million different ways. And the first way, of course, is the more common way. And he quotes scripture. He said, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. He is not talking about the world in a sinful and negative way there. He's simply talking about humanity, or the people who God has decided to show himself to. But number two is what he's talking about here. The second use of the term refers to people who lead a sinful life, people who oppose the will of God, either consciously or not, who live for the way he puts it, they live for time and not for eternity. In fact, in many cases, they can't comprehend eternity. Remember, eternity and infinity are two different things. Infinity is an infinite succession of points. It's just a massive number of something that we can't comprehend. Eternity isn't time at all. Eternity is just one eternal now. And of course, he quotes yet another. And he says, if the world hates you, he's quoting scripture here, if the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you. Quoting Christ here, of course. If you were men of the world would love you as its own, just because you are not of the world, but I have chosen you from it. That is why the world hates you. Do not love the world or things of the world. So there's two very different ways he's using the term. But he says, given this, the world essentially is this. Most people are living, either consciously or no, a sinful life, abominable in God's sight, hostile to God, as he would say. It's because the number of God's enemies is far, far greater than the number of true and faithful servants, and that ratio is getting worse and worse over time. And that's why most of the time, the Bible and patristic writings, scriptures as a whole, the world is used as a pejorative. But of course, he isn't talking about, you know, he was a true light that enlightens everyone who comes into the world. Now, that could be seen in two different ways, that the world is inherently sinful, God comes in it and alters it, at least in essence, if not in day-to-day practice. You know, because it's not just deifying human nature, human beings as individuals and families and nations have to move towards it. The will has to be engaged, not just the intellect. And the difference between conscious and subconscious rebellion is extremely difficult to pinpoint. One of the great, patristics is about psychology. It's where psychology and metaphysics meet, because both things have to happen. Our perfection lies in understanding the orthodox intellectual tradition well, only well enough to maintain a coherent, perfect system. That doesn't mean our will is going to follow that exactly. We're going to sin in the phenomenal world. And whether people have simply rejected the church and hate it almost always from ignorance, you know, they have some very stereotypical views of things, usually from the Protestant world, and they usually state it in the most, you know, ridiculous, harsh way possible, which immediately should suggest to you that they're hiding something, that they simply don't know. There's a passion, there's an anger, there's a sadness there that they probably aren't aware of. That's a conscious rejection. The difference between someone who is open about that, which is very common now, and someone who simply doesn't know he doesn't know. We talked about last week. Somehow these people associate goodness with what is legal and what the regime says through its media agents. Over time, it becomes obviously good. You know, to not be a racist or something like that, the ultimate evil, the ultimate sin in the postmodern world. But he also says that even when Christ came, the majority of people did not recognize Christ as Savior. That, in fact, the majority of people hate and hounded, as he says, with calumnies and persecutions, the true servants of God. And of course, he's talking about the apostles and their students. Remember what happened on Palm Sunday. You had a very surface, superficial love of Christ because he resurrected Lazarus. You know, he showed a sign, and they got all excited. But the minute the Judaic authority figures said, no, he is an enemy, they immediately, you know, put their palms down and picked up a stone. That had been going on back and forth. So even then, you know, you can outwardly love and support the church as a cultural matter, but have nothing to do with it in terms of either your will or intellect. But the other side to that those of us who are forced to live and work in the world, we can't reject it on the one hand and expect its praise on the other. We're going to be singled out. and people may do it, and this is only from experience, but I've heard it elsewhere too. There's a intuition that there's something different about us, that we don't approach things the same way. And there's an underlying hostility that they either are unaware of, or even if they are, they don't know where it comes from. And it's no accident. The stuff about stupidity is extremely important. That's what that would mean. Having feelings and beliefs and not being able to give account of them, or even realizing that they should. And even if somehow they realize that they should, they don't have the vocabulary or the mental wherewithal to lay it out. And that's encouraged. That's your good American. They're smart enough to do the work they have to do, but not too smart where they start questioning it. They're right in that very American mass society mid-range where, and remember, this is supposed to be the time of peace and plenty, according to the Enlightenment ideology. But he says something curious here. He's talking about the frustration and anger that we feel, that we're just surrounded by this contempt. He says, well, be content with the fact that a handful of true servants of God who you'll meet from time to time in the course of your life love you and with love and interest approve of your conduct and glorify God for and with you. Such meetings were not frequent even in the flourishing times of Christianity. And today, they've become extremely rare. In Psalm 11, save me, O Lord, there is no saint left, for truth has dwindled from the sons of men. Empty follies they talk, everyone with his neighbor. So he says, even in the golden age, you don't have people who can wrap their brain around what the ascetic life is or why it should be done. Protestantism, as I will always say, was one of the greatest evils to befall European civilization. Because not only did it cut off man from God, did it remove the universal truths that are embedded in creation, in fact, mock them and attack them, but it reduced any kind of legal or institutional presence of the church to next to nothing. And of course, the state took over. I mean, in fact, the state took over immediately. Peasants rose up and were slaughtered by the German nobility of the time. Luther pretended not to know what was going on. They misread his thought. And it wasn't too long. In fact, it was almost that very moment where the so-called Radical Reformation began. And we have all the cults and, you know, communism and always the community of women, which just meant you don't have to follow your marriage vows. And all of this collapsed in the most literate parts of Northern Europe and created a centralized state that had jurisdiction over everything. That was never the case. Never the case before. Because of that, because of the individualism here, there was never any unity left. This is where nominalism and individualism found its root. And people like John Calvin, who I think was not only was Jewish but possessed, began to sanctify the bourgeois world with his very selective reading of a rewritten and truncated scripture. And this is why he says, Ignatius says, the world is a harlot, a prostitute, that attracts those who direct their gaze to it with love and longing for its beauty. In other words, you already have to be perverted to look at that and find it worthwhile. So people who are just partly fallen, partly allured for love of the world, can't really escape before it strips him of his life. But when that world completely strips a man and carries him out of his house on the day of his death, he then realizes the world is a liar and deceiver. But by then, of course, it's too late. There is no compromise here. While serving the world, it is impossible to serve God. Then he says, a friend of the world invariably becomes, though he may not notice it himself, the most bitter enemy of God and of his own salvation. And as we already said elsewhere, this isn't a frontal assault like it used to be. Love of the world sneaks into the soul like a thief in a very stealthful kind of a way, and slowly it leads to negligence and inattention to oneself. We've all experienced this. We know how quickly something minor can become something major. And the reason why in Christ's day, and one of the many reasons why he came, that Jerusalem was the site of all of this, why it was so troubled, was because the life there of what we would later on call the rabbis of the Talmud completely perverted the temple and its and the people around it. This is why this king of righteousness, he shows up, and that people had that intuition, there's something wrong with this man. Everything Christ did went against the so-called customs, just the subconscious and unspoken rules that people followed, whether you're Roman or Judaic. Ultimately, because of this seeping love of the world, monsters like Herod and Barabbas looked to be more tolerable and acceptable to most of the people in Jerusalem than Christ himself, despite the fact that they saw him raise Lazarus with their own eyes. They saw many miracles with their own eyes. But that in and of itself, in the realm of stupidity, doesn't matter. The assumption that they could see something and then because they see it, believe it, well, people with integrity can do that. People with functional reason can do that. But most people can't. It doesn't matter. Their attachment to things is far more powerful than the testament of their own eye. You could see in the 20th century, academics, journalists, intellectuals in general, they praised the Stalinist system, the Maoist system. And in the 70s, they praised the system of Pol Pot. Many people did. Many of the intellectuals did. They'll pretend they didn't do it now. And that's to this day fully acceptable. Tsar Nicholas II, the National Socialism, anything like that, and you are in serious trouble. Noam Chomsky fully supported Pol Pot. And I mention this because it doesn't matter. The number of bodies... And the reason for the number of bodies doesn't really matter. Even if they were there seeing it with their own eyes, it wouldn't change anything. It's in the interest of the regime, and therefore, it's the wave of the future, so it just doesn't matter. Now, that's what I think is of interest in the arena. But over the years, I've put together my favorite Russian language quotes. I don't know if any of this is found in English. I've always find this man very difficult to translate. I'm not very good in the first place, but for some reason he has a style that is very difficult for me. Now I want to get away from what he claims is strictly monastic writing, although it does apply to us. And get involved in more the pan-European stuff that he was worried about. He'd rather not deal with it. But he has an essay called Concerning the Political Events in Europe in 1848. And he's talking about rationalism. Rationalism meaning, and he's not really talking about nous, and Aristotle's conception of reason. He's talking about the logic of the nihilistic world. Nihilism was what we would call today positivism. It's only these temporary truths that are organized observation, and sometimes even not our observation, as in things like astronomy, can build for us. But this eventually becomes an ideology that has only a small base in observation. Because pure empiricism in the nihilistic sense, that you can't live that way. No one could actually function with these temporary truths that could be refuted tomorrow. So certain things, whether it be evolution or the Holocaust or anything like this, this is imposed on people. Nihilists and anarchists will force this on you, not seeing the contradiction there. But that ideology, that kind of rationalism, creates chaos. Chaos in the worst sense, that there is nothing solid. There is no solid ground on which to stand. Therefore, anything could be rationalized, as well as anything could be condemned by those with the power to do so. That realism, in the Platonic sense, created a tranquil mind, and he says this explicitly. But as that fell apart, that tranquility fell to pieces. That everything that came from the Reformation shook the basic peace of peoples. But that can't be chaotic forever. Now remember when he's writing here, out of the final, in his mind, the ultimate expression of this illness, as he calls it, the genius that derives from geniuses, a lawless man, and this was, of course, Napoleon. Napoleon arising from the French Revolution. The pursuit of material things. To pursue material things, it could be, you know, utilitarianism, it could be a reputation. You know, that's all part of the world as we've defined it. But pursuing these as if they're eternal, and they're presented as eternal, even though those presenting it know it's not. Maybe subconsciously many people know it's not. So these people, modernists, live in cognitive dissonance. To what extent their actual true believers is always up in the air. The eternal, the more you focus on the world, the less you focus on things that are eternity, that are eternal. The less you do that, the more it becomes habitual. Habit and, you know, taking the easy way out, that's just as powerful, in fact, far more powerful for most people than truth. And everything that drives from the truth. The truth is like an honest man. No one really likes him, but they'll give lip service to him. And from this comes the absolute abuse and mockery of Christianity, and then from that comes the persecution. The Holy Spirit is then replaced by positive law, and positive law that is not associated with natural law, and hence eternal law. Power creates law. Law isn't discovered, it's invented. And that emanates from a ruling, either an individual like Napoleon, or a ruling class, or what I've termed the regime in more recent days. He also connects this to the widespread construction of railways. He's not the first Russian patristic scholar to condemn railways. That this is a part of the development of what he calls pandemonium. But the railway is a symbol. It's the artificial equivalent of veins and arteries in our body. He talks about the, you know, confusing the language at Babel. And that confusion gave the opportunity to carry out all kinds of sinful acts. Now, steam locomotives do the opposite. The pandemonium, God descended to Scripture to look at the deeds of men and stopped this with the confusion of tongues. Not so much now, the confusion of languages, but by replacing the world completely destroyed with iniquity with a new and glorified world in the last days. There will be victory here, is what he's talking about. Railways are continuing the struggle of the world for the mockery of the glorified new world that God will bring. This is a human attempt to do that. And this ultimately is what happens when you focus on the material at the expense of the eternal. And by eternal, we're talking about universal truth as well as anything else. He wrote a letter to Nicholas I, April 30th, 1849. a very difficult period of time. He connects the military struggle to the ascetic struggle. This has come up many times. He says, during this time, you set aside the sword. You took up the plow. When the military crisis began and it began to accumulate storm, you left the plow and again took up the sword and took with him Christian humility. And you were driven by true devotion and love for the Russian nation, the blessed Russia, the nation of the pious people. The crown, fatherland, the nation, they're one, both in the family, or like in the family, are one, parents and children also are one. And he says, develop in the Russian infantry that they are ascetics, that they are helping to bring a new and better world about by their sacrifice, that they are and should be considered martyrs of the church. That the self-forgetfulness, the gaze towards the eternal, is what creates Christian soldiers more than anything else. And in both cases, whether it be monastic, whether it be the intense ascetic struggle of being a monarch, which, Nicholas I, Alexander III, these were ascetic men, and they were ascetics. Even if they didn't want to pursue that life, they had no choice. They had no choice but to suffer with the weight of the world on their shoulders. He wrote another letter to Nicholas sometime later, May of 1863. The crisis, of course, at this point has gotten far worse. And he basically says, whether we like it or not, Russia's going to have to engage with Europe, which couldn't possibly be any more relevant now. Yet he says, human efforts cannot destroy or change the fate of Russia that God has laid out, that God has destined, and it will ultimately prevail over the world. So in an age of universal apostasy, what Russia represents, then and today, is this light in the darkness. Now he says something very tragic here. He's writing long before World War I. And he's talking about the massive population growth of the Russian Empire. And it could practically go on forever because most of Russia is empty. The population is growing by a million men, or a million people every year. 100 million, and they're going to grow exponentially. And he says the attack of envious enemies will force her to develop strength and understand her position. Well, this is Russian history. And her position is already exciting envy and intrigues. Of course, the envy and intrigue ended up being World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution, which he couldn't possibly have. He didn't predict it by any means. Some saints did at the time. But he also knew that if he's going to talk about Napoleon as the natural progression of the revolution, if Russia is going to be the target of these very same people, not just Napoleon's invasion of Russia decades earlier, but how this is going to continue in the future, that despite the fact that God will never abandon Russia, if Russia reaches the population such that she could fill the entire land area, she won't have to worry. Without World War I, our world would be a Russian one. And therefore, it would be an Orthodox one. We wouldn't need World War II. We wouldn't need any of these battles. There's nothing that they can do except possibly, in the political sense of the psychological, insinuate their way into the halls of power. And he does talk about the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel, about the Rus. And we've talked about that many times in the past. It has nothing to do with Russians, but this massive number. This people to reach an enormous material development before the end of the world. He may be talking about Russia here, but he may be talking about Russia's enemies too. Because we're at a time where the war over the Crimea has put the entire world against Russia. And we're in that situation now. Remember, Russia's not fighting, American soldiers and their private PMCs, in Ukraine. Russia is yet again fighting the entire world. But it took a long time for Europe to even take notice of Russia as an intellectual idea. It really was Peter the Great, in his mind, that brought this about. He came as a guest to Paris in 1714, according to him, and in 1814, the Russian army came to Paris after, of course, defeating Napoleon's invasion. But he doesn't say that this is the end of it. The enemies continue to threaten us. He says enemies will awaken, attack Russia, produce an involuntary development of strength within her, but won't humiliate her. They will elevate her, and such is her predestination. That's what he writes to Tsar Nicholas I. Of course, you could not possibly have understood what the Bolshevik Revolution is going to do, but even that, and everything that occurred as a result, and the Western support of it, doesn't alter the nature of his prediction. Because in 1920, no one could have predicted what would happen in 2020. He makes a distinction in 1856, a bit before then, another letter to Nicholas I. There's a big difference between the laws of the church and the laws of the state. The laws of the church are more ethereal. It's manifest an example. The canon is not a hard and fast rule like a law of a state would be. But there is something to be taken from it. This nesting identities. A bishop to be elected in the church of the city, then a regional synod, and then a national synod. Despite that, you have the ruling class all over the place electing or assisting in the election of unworthy people. But what this all comes down to, he says this in his ascetic sermon on justice, mercy, and faith, roughly around the same time, that God's instruction to the world, given to the righteous, the wise, whether it be fathers of family, spiritual, civil leaders, whatever, mentors of the people, he says, that the ultimate law is judgment, meaning truth, mercy, and a dedication to the truth, or faith. Vita, meaning faithfulness, as we would say. But what is a ruler supposed to do? It can't be ruled in the same way that a church is ruled. The first thing that a ruler has to do is govern himself. We've talked about this many times. He has to acquire power over himself. He has to be able to escape the lot of the majority, the population that can't escape. He has to do battle with the passions that create things like addictions. And therefore, if he is overcome with this stuff, he can't help but act on incorrect ideas. And that action leads to disorder in society. If rulers can do it, then so could I, is what people will say. The consequence of all of this is what he says is public and private atrocities, growing to enormous proportions. But once the ruler acquires power over himself, they must then acquire power over the passions of secondary, their subordinate, for the exact same way. This is something that Nicholas I was able to do. What Alexander III was able to do, but Nicholas II had a tough time with. Any of us would have a tough time. And he's talking about the infiltration of the Russian ruling class by rationalism, in the sense that he's used the term, using flattery, slander, anything to get their way. But if a ruler doesn't watch himself and isn't able to discipline himself morally, he will turn into their instrument. This is the exact opposite of Machiavelli. The connection between church law and law of the state is that only church law and the light of spiritual reason is a ruler, a monarch, or a good ruler connected to him, is going to be able to expose the evil of the world, the malice and the slander and the selfishness. The opposite happens if the ruler is carried away, as Napoleon was. Napoleon is just an example, of course. The revolution is the mind, the intellectual fundament. But the mind creates, you know, is connected to a will, and that will is Napoleon. We could use that example all over the place, not just in politics. So someone like Napoleon is going to be very logical and very devious, but have no reason. The minute a monarch loses his reason and gives himself over to passions, he then will rule incorrectly. He'll judge one-sidedly. He'll make many errors. He'll support factions. But even the best of rulers, rulers of the kindest heart and purest benevolence, have lost their connection to the spiritual world. And they've committed crimes. They've become the cause of disaster. You can't have mercy where there's no truth and justice. One is connected to the other two. So to do works of mercy, you have to know the truth. It has to be just. Now, justice alone, giving everything its, you know, its due importance, giving the right people the right thing in proportion to their merit, by itself, that doesn't work. There also is mercy, which is not connected to simple justice. And even truth, just by itself, without any action, is meaningless. So there can be no mercy without judgment and justice. The connection, of course, is great grace to the actions of the Holy Spirit. And this way, even well-intentioned actions, if from a biased foundation, will lead to some variant of evil. And over time, as he says, crowns their vice and tramples on the virtue and virtuous. So judgment, mercy, that's fine, but you already have to know the truth of the matter to know where to apply it and how to apply it. And there is nothing easy about this. No one would voluntarily want this kind of power, which is why, you know, liberal democracy is such a mockery. That in the happiness of others, in the happiness of the state, the ruler finds his own happiness. And that goes for us too. Judgment is the ability to act on truth. And act on truth in the light of eternal principles. To therefore curb the evil that tries to seduce us. That goes for monarchs, that goes for us. When we possess the truth, this is how we evaluate acts of virtue and actual merit, whether it's true or not. And only from then are we able to show mercy on those who are worthy of mercy. Remember, forgiveness two people are involved in forgiveness. It's the person who's in a position to forgive and that person's asking. The New Testament story of the noble who forgives a very large debt. You know, the guy comes into his court and he's begging forgiveness. And he grants it to him out of pity. The same guy turns around and one of his subordinates wants a small debt forgiven and he tells him to go to hell. This is what he's talking. He doesn't cite that story, but I think about it quite often. The noble who forgave the larger debt was an error. He didn't know the guy well enough to realize this guy really is even a small debt he won't forgive. So while there was mercy there, there was neither justice nor judgment. And given the context of that story, it seems that the first man begging for the forgiveness of the huge loan or the huge debt was acting. You know, the parables, they're short, but they're so evocative of everything else. We fully understand what he's talking about. But in no case is there mere forgiveness just abstractly. Forgiveness requires an approach, an outward action that suggests that we know that we've messed up badly. We got ourselves in too deep in debt or whatever. And the very act of forgiving a debt, you know, today that's just, you have to be very powerful. You have to be in the club. You have to be in the ruling class to have debts forgiven, to be bailed out. Normal people don't. It's a machine. There's really no one to talk to about it. And then he talks about the Old Testament, the retreat of our new Israel from grace is no different than the old Israel. Now, we're not talking about the corrupted Jews of more modern times. But there has to be an ideological foundation, and then the consequences derive from it. That's why the ideology and the philosophy come first, the theology. And then once that's suitably perverted and basically accepted by at least people who matter, then the acts begin. And the acts are organized, and they're based on a new ruling class. The killing of the king, which is this very broad-based myth in the true sense of the word, about how an aristocracy becomes oligarchy. They're only superficially connected. In fact, they're opposite. But when the entire world is like this, when the entire regime, which is essentially global, is like this, then the son of perdition will be revealed. That's why there can be no Antichrist without universal perversion. Just like some of us are struggling to be able to receive grace, both now and after our death, the bulk of the planet is preparing to receive its opposite. But it has to be preceded by a clear apostasy from Christ. An apostasy that's so extensive that it will almost summon Adam Cadman, the new man, the revolutionary new man that the French revolutionaries and the Soviet revolutionaries talked about. Remember, from the alchemical labs of the Medici family in Renaissance Italy, all the way through our own day, whether it be bank bailouts or digital currencies, it's all one and the same. They're creating new men, they're creating new consciousness. In alchemy, of course, alchemy is really talking about people, not lead and gold. Though those are symbols, Saturn and the Sun, etc. But really, it all comes down to money, material occupations, and pleasures. Whatever fantasy is taken as normative at the time, this will attract in a time of globalization, which he notes here, the entire attention of mankind. Well, he has to imply a infrastructure to allow that to happen. And it's the same thing in the days of Noah, where you had a much smaller number of people. So as it was in Noah, it will be the same at the end, the days of the Son of Man. People are doing whatever they want. They're pretty miserable, but they're told that they're happy, so I guess it works. Then Christ comes. Same thing in the days of Lot. And they say, you know, Noah and fellow citizens of Lot were involved in immeasurable depravity. But debauchery, degeneration, degenerate behavior is born from a deviation from God, a total striving for the occupations and reputation and money, whatever fulfills the fantasy that we have in our head, which never gets filled. When to think about God, when to cultivate your salvation for that very same person who's constantly and exclusively occupied with earthly affairs, with material development. There is no time. That's why John Calvin was so evil, because he tried to combine the two, pretending that he was using the Old Testament. That kind of either quasi-Judaic or fully Judaic rule can't exist without the breakup of the church, of course, which began around the turn of the millennium, and then the Reformation, and then the old believer schism in the East, and on, a weaker and weaker presence. The monastic and the true Episcopal Orthodox Church, either side of Europe, then can the once the foundation of virtue is laid, then the consequence comes. You know, the early Protestants were relying on the maintenance of the old, whether it be the old Western Catholic or Orthodox tradition. But since they rejected that tradition, it was just hanging on. And once that tradition began to crumble away, you now have modernity. You have the symbolic railways that's connecting everything and thereby making merchants the rulers of the world. But universal debauchery, as he says. Together, though, not just by itself, but together with and because of the most abundant material development, which ultimately is the cause, that will be the sign of the end of the age and the approaching last judgment. Now, to be depraved, to be degenerate, in the broad sense, this will become the mark of mankind. This will be the last days. There'll be a lot more people, and there'll be a lot more people, mass society, because it requires huge population increases, who only have the capacity. This, again, is a matter of stupidity. And it's a matter of pity that money, power, pride, swindlers being virtuous, the breakdown of the family, he says in the Russian, is opposing a parent, being ungrateful, non-righteous, love being redefined or simply non-existent, no sense of compromise coming from pride, slander, the use of drugs, treason is a normal matter, arrogance, pomposity, and having this be the ruling class, and something that, as we know today, is enforced. Sin will reach its full development here, and we are living in the midst of it. The more violent the sin, the more violent the depravity, the stronger it becomes. Because even decent people have no place to stand. They don't know their history. They don't know their tradition. They don't know how to argue against the regime because everything is done on their turf. And it's a battle even for the best of us. It got to the point where people simply, in ancient Israel, they couldn't comprehend religion. I've written on this at great length that it got to the point, after Solomon, of course, that no one could tell the difference between Baal in general or Astaroth or any of these people and Yahweh. They were including them as one thing. They couldn't tell the difference anymore. That was temporarily arrested, of course, coming back from Babylon with the great Ezra, but that was very temporary. Don't forget what happened in Ezra's era. His own people began attacking him. He was too harsh. He was too difficult. It's much nicer to be popular by giving whatever people want, but it can't last. And it's exactly when the world will proclaim, according to St. Ignatius, when the world will proclaim and exalt its prosperity, that we have controlled nature. Remember, Stalin had a whole department of the control over nature. That once the world reaches this tremendous cryogenic prosperity, this indestructible sense of their own worth, that's where the destruction will come. That's where the end of the world will come. And from our point of view, it'll be the time of our greatest despondency, because it seems that nothing could move the regime. And it really doesn't matter at this point, because the world has become so blind, they don't realize that they're living in a dystopia. Because their bars are gold, or they're told that it's more like it, the bars aren't gold, they're told it's gold, and therefore they accept it. They think that they're living in a time of prosperity. The idiot will walk down a city street and see 100 surveillance cameras and have to give cards and identities, a massive debt, and will call himself free. Not because he really thinks that, but because he doesn't know what else to call it. And he's been told it. They live in a void. This is why I needed to speak of stupidity. We're not talking about ignorance. We're talking about someone who simply, because of many factors, doesn't have the capacity to understand anything other than these material goods. And sometimes not even that. Abundant earthly prosperity. And then in the Russian, he says, huge earthly enterprises. A prediction of the gigantism of the Soviet, this colossalism, that, well, it's obvious to everybody, are set forth by the church and the scriptures of all types. A sign of the last time, and it's as he says, the ripened sinfulness of mankind. This will all be very superficial. That's going to be the time where it ends. No one wants to declare themselves evil. No one calls themselves evil. It wants to show itself virtuous, although, of course, these words are always changing meaning. The point he's trying to make is that the way the regime functions is that the attachments to so-called material progress can embrace a person entirely. It could take everything from him. It will take his identity. The regime in their AI nonsense, says that because the human brain functions like a computer, therefore, a computer is a human brain. I mean, they don't believe in spirits or freedom or virtue. Whatever the latest technological thing, they use that as a metaphor for how human beings function. Lemaître did it in the 17th century with the machine, calling his book The Human Machine. Whatever the latest thing is. And people tend to, PR firms tend to exaggerate how wonderful everything's going to be because this machine has been created. And very few people are able to criticize that. Because, yeah, they do function like a computer. They're not supposed to, but they do. When stupidity is connected with deviousness, and they are, that's not a contradiction. Stupid people can be very devious. They don't have a soul. They don't have a spirit. They're only human in an equivocal sense. They do function like a computer, and therefore there's no difference between artificial intelligence and regular intelligence. And we're seeing that every day. The implications of that have only just begun. And while people have this intuitive revulsion to it, we all know how it works. They'll slowly impose it on everybody, and people will be used to it, and then in a very short time, it becomes natural and normal. We've always had it. Well, we know. You cannot serve both. Till this Lent, please reread some of St. Ignatius. He's an extraordinary writer. I've only touched the surface here. I've only just begun talking about him. He's the perfect Lenten reading. And see what we can do about putting this in action as much as humanly possible. Because the truth or justice without action is meaningless, without driving ourselves crazy. Thank you, as always, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.